Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome Everybody to the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, August 7, 2015, as I'm coming to you today from Santa Fe, New Mexico, just about 1 hour south of Los Alamos, New Mexico. And why is this important? Because before Los Alamos National Laboratories was established, Los Alamos was the home of the Manhattan Project, which created the first two nuclear bombs, Fat Man and Little Boy, which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, in 1945. Why am I here at this time? Because yesterday was the 70th anniversary of the dropping of Little Boy on Hiroshima, and Sunday will be the 70th anniversary of the dropping of Fat Man on Nagasaki. And tomorrow is also my 70th birthday, and I chose to spend this momentous birthday in Santa Fe because this weekend a huge anti-war conference is taking place here, along with vigils at Los Alamos. Perhaps some of you saw the article I posted this week on Facebook, on which and also on my website, which was entitled, On the Tail of Enola Gay, What on Earth Am I Doing Here?, which is a personal reflection on my birth just 2 days after Hiroshima and 1 day before Nagasaki. Enola Gay, of course, was the name of the U.S. Army airplane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and it has been very important for me to celebrate this particular birthday near the origins of the nuclear age I was born into. Because of the momentous significance of this weekend, I'm going to read a poem before I introduce our guest today. It was sent to me yesterday by my really good friend Janice, and the synchronicity of receiving it in preparation for today's show is amazing. Here is the poem written by a survivor of Hiroshima. It's entitled, How Could I Ever Forget That Flash? How could I ever forget that flash of light? In a moment, 30,000 people ceased to be. The cries of 50,000 killed at the bottom of crushing darkness. Through yellow smoke whirling into light, buildings split, bridges collapsed, crowded trams burnt as they rolled about Hiroshima, all full of boundless heaps of embers. Soon after, skin dangling like rags, with hands on breasts, treading upon the broken brains, wearing shreds of burn cloth around their loins, there came numberless lines of the naked, all crying. Bodies on the parade ground scattered like jumbled stone images of Jizo. Crowds in piles by the riverbanks, loaded upon rafts fashioned to the shore, turned by and by into corpses under the scorching sun, in the midst of flame tossing against the evening sky. Round about the street where mother and brother were trapped alive under the fallen house, the fire blood shifted on beds of filth along armory floors, heaps, and God knew who they were. Heaps of schoolgirls lying in refuse, pot-bellied, one-eyed, with half their skin peeled off, bald. The sun shone and nothing moved, but the buzzing flies in the metal basins reeking with stagnant odor. How can I forget that stillness prevailing over the city of 300,000? Amidst that calm, how can I forget the entreaties of departed wife and child through the orbs of their eyes, cutting through our minds and souls? That poem was written by Mitsuo Yoshi Toge, born in Hiroshima in 1917. He was a poet, and he was in Hiroshima when the atomic bomb was dropped on that city, August 6, 1945, when he was 24 years old at that time, and then he died at the age of 36. His firsthand experience of the bomb, his passion for peace, and his realistic insight into the event made him a leading poet on Hiroshima. So, because of the significance of this weekend and its significance in my own life, I decided that it's because my birthday weekend and I get to have my guest, you know, any guest I want, because it is my birthday weekend, I'd have the most appropriate guest on this show that I could think of, and that would be Mimi Gurman. Now, Mimi, of course, is no stranger to this show. She was a guest on the Lifeboat Hour many times when Mike Rupert was hosting it. And, of course, she and I were Mike's last guests on the show the night he died. Since then, I believe Mimi has been on the show at least twice. And on this very special weekend, I wanted her to be my guest and to talk about what must be talked about on this weekend. As many of you know, her last name is Gurman, pronounced with a hard G, like the country, and she says of herself, "I'm not an expert on anything other than one who has to date figured out how to be still standing here on Earth. I am a human being and an Earth activist. I am a witness. I care about the Earth, my animals and plants, and I care about those who get fucked over by the system. I do not care so much for most people. I'm also an activist against humans breeding. I've been a no-nuker since I was 15 or 16. I'm 50 years old. My animals are my children and my little farm, my food, as much as possible. I'm a straight shooter. I'm not diplomatic. At the same time, I can listen very well and change my views if someone shows me my views are wrong. But you would need a strong argument to do that," she says. "I created a radiation information site called Radcast, where I collect data and give it to the world for free for those who want it. It is a fact at this point in history that the governments around the world will not tell us what we are in store for regarding Fukushima and all other nuke plants waiting to explode or melt down. The government is now oil, nukes, pharmaceuticals, warlords, pimps and drug dealers, self-serving oligarchical kings who would rather watch the poor die than lend a hand with money or food at any given point. War will always come first, and I fight primarily for the closure of all nukes. Now I fight just to survive. Now I witness, because there is not much time left, and yet, what a time it is." That's Mimi's introduction of herself, and you can find her at radcast.org, R-A-D-C-A-S-T, radcast.org. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Mimi, or I should say welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so glad you read that poem. I know that you and I talked about that poem yesterday, and just listening to it again brings chills to me one more time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I felt like I had to read it. And thank you, Janice, my friend, for sending that to me. And, you know, the timing was perfect. And I want to let everyone know that later in the show we'll be accepting calls. And you can call Mimi or myself with a question at 888-874-4888. So, Mimi, you know, as we talked about in emails this past week, you and I were both born at momentous times in history. I've just described the context of my birth, but you were born in another watershed era around the time of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and I'd like you to say more about that and how it informed and influenced the work you're doing now.
I was born the day before JFK was shot, and later in my life I was thinking, you know, I already knew that I was kind of the black sheep in my family, and I shouldn't use that term. That's really, I guess, pretty derogatory now that I think about that. I was the outcast in my family. I was the outsider, the one who chose to need answers to questions that had no answers. And later I figured out, when I was born, the day after I was born, Kennedy gets killed and the entire world is full of grief. And I'm just, you know, I'm very, very small. And I was thinking about all the other people who were born on the same day, on November 21st, 1963, and how much that grief affected their lives. And, you know, we don't know. We know that our surroundings affect us for forever. Our upbringing affects us for forever. And I don't know how much that has affected me, but I can only say that somewhere inside me on a deep cellular level, I know that it has affected me. And it's very interesting meeting you, having, you know, you having been born at this time, 70 years ago, how it's affected your life and who you've become. And here we are, activists. You know, we just sort of put this together and think that it has shaped us, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. You know,
go ahead.
Well, no, these are very scary and powerfully sad times, but also very exciting times, don't you think?
I do. I think that the more we are aware, the more, you know, we are able to witness in full body. And sometimes that's a really hard thing to do, and other times it's also very shaping. It tells you where you want to be, what you're doing, where you're going, rather than falling into this very, very fast pace that we're all in, whether we want to be in it or not. I was just talking about that this morning with my partner about how fast everything has become, how everything is escalating at such a rapid rate, whether it's rapid climate change or people freaking out or people staying unaware or fighting to swim upstream. And while I'm saying all this, there's a hummingbird right outside the window, getting her honey, her juices from these flowers all around me. And we've set up our environment in such a way where we can see this and bring this into our consciousness, because otherwise we're just left with the speed, the escalation of everything that's going on around us. And it's too hard to deal with. We have to find our calm and find our path and find our way to walk through this time.
Absolutely, and I want to talk about that some more a little later in the show, but I'm wondering, what's been your understanding of the creation of the bomb and the events that have transpired in relation to nuclear weapons and nuclear energy in the past 70 years?
Well, my feeling about it is that if there's a place where science can go wrong, it was with the creation of the bomb. The idea of creating a bomb was an idea that went wrong, I think. I believe that. And I think that the creation of nukes and nuclear power and nukes for, you know, plutonium for bombs, the digging of uranium to make all of this happen so that we kill the indigenous people in the process, which was all part of the plan, I think. It's all part of the same spectrum. And so when science collides with human nature, chaos can ensue, and it certainly has in this case. And we have nuclear bombs, we have nuclear power, which are nuclear bombs as well. We now have small modular reactors, which have all come from this idea over the past 70 years. All of the nuclear power plants that were built, you know, 30 to 40 years ago are all falling apart, everyone. We're filled with lies about how safe we are, while at the same time, we are living in a disaster. So they're lying to us while we are living in the disaster that this idea has perpetuated. We have Hiroshima, we have Nagasaki, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima. We will always have Fukushima. Indian Point, the Columbia Generating Station, Diablo Canyon, Pilgrim. I mean, I could go on 400 times to name what has happened in the last 70 years. And we will never not have this, because we will always have the waste from these nuclear plants. We will always have these bombs, no matter how we decommission them. We will always have the threat of death from the actual weapons themselves, not including the nuclear power plants. We live in denial, most of us, who live anywhere near a nuclear power plant, let alone the entire world collectively, is in denial that we have any semblance of safety around us with all of these decrepit plants. So that is what has happened in the last 70 years. Science hit humanity, and humanity took it in a way that was absurd and has created mass terrorism. And that's what we're all living in. But it's a lot easier to not know anything about nuclear.
It certainly is. And I want to get into a little later in the show more of the perils of nuclear energy. But I'd like to just for a moment go back to the Manhattan Project and talk more about something I wrote in my article this past week regarding the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. You know, in the article I quoted one of my great heroes, Howard Zinn, from his amazing book, The People's History of the United States, in which he's very clear that it was not necessary to drop the bomb. As World War II was coming to a close and as Germany had surrendered 3 months prior, the U.S. had been feeling out Japan for terms of surrender for some time. And in August of 1945, the Japanese were willing to surrender with just one condition, and that was that their emperor could remain in power, which the United States refused to consider. Had that one condition been granted, the Japanese would have surrendered in July, if not earlier. But the decision to drop the bomb was based on factors that were much larger than whether or not the Japanese could keep their emperor. The United States had been very paranoid of the Soviet Union for decades, even though the Soviet Union was an ally of the United States in World War II. The U.S. knew that Russia was likely to become a competing superpower, and so in order to deter Russia from doing so, in order to be the kid on the block with the biggest stick, the U.S. decided to drop the bomb as a way of threatening the Soviet Union. And another factor in the decision, of course, was racism. The United States had been at war with Japan for 4 years, and the very man who headed the Manhattan Project, General Leslie Groves, was also the man in charge of establishing internment camps for Japanese citizens in the U.S. So the two largest factors in making the decision to drop the bomb were imperialist military superiority and racism, not, as the U.S. government claimed, that dropping the bomb would end the war sooner and save thousands of lives. So what in fact happened is that dropping the bomb engendered an enormous arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union. And within the past 70 years, 9 nations now possess nuclear weapons, something like 60,000, I believe. So, Mimi, as you reflect on these facts and other facts about the dropping of the bomb that I haven't mentioned that you might be aware of, what's your perspective on the entire tragedy?
Well, the first part is that, you know, we have people who are wonderful, like Howard Zinn, who can help us understand what the real history was of the United States. And even in hearing what our true history was, there's still denial about what our history was. And the denial comes in from the big PR campaigns on any governmental front, especially ours. And it's still amazing to me that people can deny the way that they deny both what happened in World War II in Japan, what happened currently. And, you know, it sort of does come back to, I'll bring it back to General Leslie Groves. You know, so much of this for me is a continuation of the patriarchal system where men fantasize over the greatness of the phallus. And in this case, the phallus is the bomb. So perhaps it's true. I don't know. I haven't studied this, and I don't really feel the need to study it because for me it's just pretty apparent. You can't create life, and you are, you know, there's something wrong with you, you know. If you can't create life, the next most powerful alternative to that is, to what extent can you create massive death and devastation? What is the opposite effect that you can have that is stronger in your mind than the creation of all life? And I think that the patriarchal system has created this, or instilled this mindset into so many men on our planet. And so we have this, you know, the power at the time rising up over the people. It clenches this erect phallus in the shape of a bomb, and it thrusts it out over a population to show what kind of evil could ensue, making sure that their power was actuated, that it is understood who is in power here. Oh, the United States is in power here. And making sure that people will listen. So there's a subservient people. And this is the same dynamic in abusive relationships. And this has become, to me, the abusive relationship here is between man, as in men, and their victims, which is Mother Earth. And this is what we're dealing with still today. We deal with this with Obama. You know, he's hired the vice president of Monsanto, Michael Taylor, to become the head of the FDA, who was promoted from being the czar, the U.S. food safety czar, to have full control over the food contaminants that we eat. It's not the health of the food that he's in control over. He allows Monsanto, the other bomb, to come into our reality, making sure that we see who is powerful over us, who can create death instead of life, which we are affected by because they're killing us. You know, it's the same dynamic. And until we start talking about the dynamic, or continue to talk about the dynamic of this patriarchal system, which creates war and the mechanisms of war, then we are not going to get anywhere at all. And we will see more bombs, and we will see more threats, and we will see those threats carried out. I do believe that if we can't get a handle on the weapons that we have, and as well, we can't start to shut down the nuclear power plants, which are, you know, some 440 weapons out there waiting to kill massive amounts of people.
Thank you for that, Mimi. And in a few minutes, we're going to be taking callers. And if you have a question for Mimi or myself, call us at 888-874-4888. In my article on the tale of Enola Gay, I noted the crisis of conscience that J. Robert Oppenheimer, the scientist in charge of the Manhattan Project, went through in the years that he worked on developing the bomb. And at every turn, he submitted to the pressures on him from a behemoth patriarchal system, and he refused to follow his conscience. Throughout the entire history of the nuclear age up until the present moment, human beings have created, continued to create, this horrifying nightmare because they refuse to follow their conscience, because they've been obsessed, as you said, with military superiority, cheap energy consumption, or some other objective that completely disregards the ecological and humanitarian price we pay for employing nuclear fission. It's a prime example of how technology, you know, that we believe will save us can do nothing but kill us. So we're going to get to Fukushima in a moment, but in the 1970s, the United States began constructing these nuclear power plants in this country, and this insane notion received a jump start, so to speak, from the energy crisis that was happening in this country in the 70s. So, Mimi, I'm wondering, what's the overall situation with nuclear power plants in this country and in the other hundreds of nuclear power plants that you mentioned around the world? I know you mentioned that, you know, they're falling apart, but can you be more specific?
Oh, sure. All of the power plants, all of the nuclear power plants in the United States and around the world that are 30 to 40 years old at this point have had major amounts from day one of their existence of and ongoing through today of neutron bombardment into the concrete, the cement, the pipes, the wires, the steel, everything in these power plants, everything that makes the structure work, or, you know, supposed to work, all of that has had major amounts of degradation due to neutron bombardment of, from the fuel rods, from, you know, nuclear energy being created. And so the state of nuclear power just among the power plants themselves it's deadly right now. They are leaking. Everyone leaks, whether we are aware of it or not. They all leak when they are going down for a planned refueling. We do know that, and we have papers on that directly from the NRC, which talk to us about that. So they're aware of it, too, but the people aren't aware of that. So, you know, they can only admit to leakage when there's a planned refueling. They won't admit to it elsewhere unless you go and look for it, if you're lucky. So, yeah, every nuclear power plant needs to be taken down. They need to cool down. We need to get the waste out. We need to at least get the waste in some form of storage away from where it is right now, and then someplace more permanent. And we don't have that. That place doesn't exist, and this is the biggest problem. When you don't have a place to store nuclear waste, and we talk about, well, we need a place to store nuclear waste, we kind of go around in circles because there isn't a safe place to store nuclear waste. And here we are. I mean, what do we do with that conundrum? One of the things that I thought we should do with that is put all of the, take a mouse percentage of the money that goes into war and bring that to our science universities, you know, the MITs, the whoever, and let them focus their attention on a way to devise safety containment for nuclear waste. As of today, we don't have that at all. But if, you know, if we could get that, that would be a win. But I don't, we're not putting any money into it. So that's sort of the state right now. They're all falling apart, and they really do need to be shut down.
Yeah, and, you know, I was made very aware yesterday when I was in Los Alamos of the situation with the waste, because they have a huge area back of their laboratory between canyons where they dump the stuff. But they also have, a lot of it is carried down to the Carlsbad Cavern area and southern New Mexico, where they have the WIP site, which have had accidents over the last couple of years. And so this conundrum of, my God, what do you do with all this waste, you know, it just seems absolutely overwhelming.
It is overwhelming, and as many listeners might know, the WIP plant had an explosion of waste in one of their tanks, I think at this point 2 years ago, I can't remember the exact date, and they denied any leakage at the time, and we found out quickly that it had leaked. Not only had the radiation leaked out into the public, but plutonium had leaked out into the public and was found elsewhere, outside the perimeters. So this is a place where everybody said, we will have storage for our waste for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years with this, and it lasted 20 before this happened. I think it was 20. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure if 20 is the correct answer, but yeah, and this just goes to show that anything you do with nuclear waste, nuclear weapons, nuclear power, always will fail. There will always be a failure, no matter which way you turn. And the hubris, and those with, you know, the men out there telling you that everything is going to be fine, they just say that. We know now that this is not true. The reason that Arne Gundersen is out there expressing his disbelief in nuclear power now as a former nuclear engineer is because every single system failed at Fukushima. And that was thought to be impossible. And we have no backup systems. We pretend we have backup systems. But in the final outlook on nuclear power, we have no backup system. When you can't store waste, you have no backup system.
That is phenomenal, isn't it? That humanity created this tragedy without any real forethought of what you would do with the waste. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
I don't even know if they did, if they had forethought and thought, you know, they said, well, what will we do with that? I don't know that they would have cared so much, just because the way that the people who created nuclear weapons came together and did their work was in such a way where looking into human health was completely disregarded. In fact, they used humans as guinea pigs. During the green run at Hanford, they let radiation out to see what would happen. They knew that people were going to get killed from uranium mining, the indigenous people. That happened. You know, they're still sick from that generations later.
They also injected people at Oak Ridge, correct? With plutonium, correct?
There were so many experiments that went on. It was like the Mengele show, but in the United States. And mm-hmm. and we look at Mengele with such what's the word I'm looking for? Just disgust. And here we have the same. We had the same thing going on. In order to find out how many rads a person could handle before getting sick, we experimented on people in the beginning with x-rays. You know, how much radiation will create burn, and let's see, and then, oh wait, that's a little bit too much, so we should back off, or if we use a little bit more, then we can maybe do more damage, and maybe we need to think about that. And all of these things went into the making of those bombs.
Absolutely. Well, we're opening the lines now to callers. If you have any questions for Mimi and me, you know, to have Mimi on the show with this body of knowledge that she has regarding radiation, regarding nuclear weapons, nuclear power plants, is such an amazing opportunity. So we'd love it if you'd call us at 888-874-4888. We'd really like to hear from you. So let's move on up, Mimi, to March 11, 2011, one of the strongest, if not the strongest, earthquakes in Japanese history slams the Fukushima Daiichi power plant, sending it into meltdown. And normally, the waters used to cool the reactors in such a situation would have kicked in and the cooling would have begun. But shortly after the quake, the tsunami that the quake triggered slammed the power plant and knocked out the diesel fuel tanks that would have provided power for the cooling process. And that was a disaster that neither the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, or the workers at Fukushima could have ever anticipated. And as a result, no one was prepared to deal with it, and as a matter of fact, no one is really prepared to deal with the consequences, which will continue for centuries, as you've mentioned. So, Mimi, you've been researching Fukushima since it happened, and I'd really like you to give us your updated perspective on what's happened since March 11, 2011, and what we can expect in the future.
Well, I'd like to go back to what actually happened on that because the PR around that seemed to stick with a lot of people's understanding. And the first thing that happened was the earthquake. And the earthquake did create cracks in at Fukushima in the power plants. And the cracks were really important. They were very well hidden. TEPCO did not want the public to know that the earthquake had created cracks. And we know now through the Freedom of Information Act documents that those cracks happened during the earthquake. So we had a problem at the earthquake. And the reason that I stress this is that the Columbia Generating Station power plant, which is here in Washington, right next to Hanford, is situated on 12 fault lines. Diablo Canyon in California, in San Luis Obispo, is situated on something around 12 to 15 or so. I don't even know how many fault lines that's on. And it's the fault lines that are the concern right now with these two power plants, as well as Fukushima in the future. But the fault line, if we get these earthquakes that are expected for the West Coast, and at some point we will, Diablo Canyon will be in the sea. And regardless of a tsunami following, the earthquake will take it down. And it will take down the waste that's located there as well, and it will also take down probably the Columbia Generating Station due to the earthquakes. So this is a really important piece of information to have, that Fukushima happened because of the earthquake. Secondarily, it was taken down due to the tsunami. The tsunami did cut out the generating system, the power system. So, you know, we have this as a twofold problem. And at this point, there is no stopping Fukushima from continuing its radiation going into the ocean. There's no stopping that. There's no stopping the corium. The three of the cores have released. They're outside the building. We don't know where they are. They're under the ground. They're, you know, who knows? The cameras that go into the power plants get burned out before they can really tell us too much other than, you know, Elvis has left the building. And now what we deal with are the illnesses. And there are studies that have come out. The thyroid studies that have come out very recently have shown us that they're far worse than we were originally told. We who follow this seem to figure that this was going to be the case anyway, since TEPCO is based on lies. And the Japanese government has put a mandate out where nobody can talk to the press about what's really going on. So we're working through black cloth. You know, we're working through the darkness to get our information. But we do know that the rise in thyroid cancers in children is rising at a very rapid rate. And we're watching that. And it's a terrible thing. But it is happening. And there's really, folks, there's no stopping Fukushima. They wouldn't allow an international team to come in to try to help figure out how this could maybe be solved in the very beginning. Japan wouldn't. And here we are. We are at a a leak that is larger than anything any of us can imagine, and it is radiating our planet.
And Mimi, we have a caller. We have Matt from New York. Go ahead, Matt.
You know me, Carolyn. It's Mayat, M-A-A-T.
Okay, sorry about that.
That's okay. It's the comedic goddess or principle of right, justice, balance, and truth. A very, very interesting program. I have a three-part question. I'll listen over the air. I had to be on the phone, so I hope I'm not being repetitive about these subjects. But first of all, I'd like Mimi. Yesterday I heard a report about some women in California having skin drooping, which is related to radiation poisoning. So if she knows anything about that, I'd also like some update on the Japanese politics. I know at one point they had passed some crazy law eliminating free speech around it. And then more recently, I heard a report, I think it was on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, and she did have a very good report. I think it was on yesterday.
It was yesterday, but, yeah.
Yes, yes. And in other words, the Japanese politics where they seem to, the TECO, what is that company where they're
TEPCO. TEPCO, yeah. Do you have a specific question?
Yes. If I'm correct, they're being, give us some update on the politics, because I understand, if I heard it correctly, that there's some criminal charges forthcoming. Not that that's going to, you know, mean a rat's tootie in terms of the great devastation. If she knows of any technologies, because BAI used to have a person that was doing much, much more reporting on that, that could deal with the waste. And about fish, for those of us who are fish salmon lovers, and of course the larger mammals are being affected, give us some idea whether there's a way about around the testing of our fish. And if you have my questions, Mimi, and thank you so much, Carolyn, for this program. I'll listen over the air.
Okay, thanks, Mayette. Go ahead, Mimi.
Okay, got it. That's a lot of questions, and I think I have your answers. So first, yes, there is a blackout on information still from Japan to the public. So the information that we get comes out from brave people who just get that out to us. So yes to the blackout. I'm jumping around. The fish.
That's fine.
You are definitely taking your life in your own hands when you are eating now from the Pacific. We do know that there are many different animals in the ocean that have been affected by radiation. The tuna is affected, herring is affected. We know that it's in the plant life, it is in seaweed, and so basically we start from the bottom up, and that is exactly how it is. We are now seeing that the dolphins that are near Fukushima that are dying are radiated. So I'm going to make a definitive statement right now, and that is that the animal life and the plant life in the ocean is now affected by radiation, and you choose with your own life how you want to deal with that regarding what you eat. As far as testing that food, Radcast can accept certain samples. You can email me at info@radcast.org and tell me what samples you might have that you want tested for radioisotopes. We share information with three different labs, and we are also working at collecting some money from the public. We do everything for free, Radcast does, to buy new equipment for our lab. And if you would like to donate to us, you can also go to radcast.org and make a donation there. So as far as sampling goes, there are places that can be sampled. You know, we can sample soil, we can sample plants, we can sample food. And things are coming up that are radiated. I think I might have hit that. Yes, and there are people from Fukushima who are now being brought to court. We don't know what's going to happen yet. It's a very slow process. And I think that's all the answers I have right now for those questions.
Well, I appreciate that. So I want to ask you, we might come back, if we have time, we'll come back to Fukushima, but more recently, like this week, you and Helen Caldicott have been working on an article together and doing some, she's been doing some editing, and it was published today on the Counterpunch website. It's called Follow the Radiation. Will you tell us about it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. One of the things I noticed a long time ago, since 311 occurred, was if you look at the NRC, the NRC will put out, the NRC website, they put out what's called an event page. And the event page is something that has happened at a nuclear plant anywhere in the United States. It could be the piping has gone wrong, a valve won't turn, the water system is broken, the backup system is broken. Anything like this has to be reported by the nuclear plant to the NRC, and then the NRC puts it out to the public. So I read those. And if you go then I would go to the EPA's website where radiation is put out on graphs. And we've learned how to read those graphs. And I realized this year that if we compare the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's events to the EPA's graphs, we can actually see if radiation leaked during those events. And that's the only way that we can find this out, because they won't tell us if things leak. And what I discovered was, since May 9th through about June 23rd or June 26th of this year, the Columbia Generating Station, which was going down for refueling and then reopening, had a series of radiation leaks in Washington that coincided with each nuclear event that was listed on the NRC's page. So what I did was I superimposed the events onto the graph from the EPA, and I wrote an article about what I was seeing, which basically, in summary, says, during these particular events over these 3 months or 4 months, Washington was receiving radiation leaks from the Columbia Generating Station and was not told. So none of the people in Tri-Cities, which is the area surrounding the Columbia Generating Station and Hanford and wherever the wind blows, further east into Spokane and Idaho, further north into Canada, nobody was notified. And you can now, if you go to the article, you can see what radiation leaks look like on the EPA site, because I've given you those charts. And that's what I put together. And what Helen added to the article was, well, she helped me out with clarity, and she was able to help me express what some of these problems are for you when you don't receive iodine tablets, when you don't know you're being radiated. And I really want everybody to know that you are unsafe if you live near a nuclear power plant, and it doesn't matter what nuclear power plant you live near, because during refueling outages, you will get radiation from that plant. It will come out. The EPA agrees, the NRC agrees, and in the article there's an entire report that's put out by nuclear power plants showing you that they know this too. You're the only one who doesn't know that you're getting radiated, and you're the only one who is sitting there saying nuclear power is safe, and nuclear power is an alternative along with other green energies like solar and wind, because that's the PR line that you've been given, when all the while you are being radiated. So we need to smarten up, and we need to start to learn how to think critically, and we need to start to ask the right questions and follow these things so that we know that nuclear plants are killing us.
Well, I'd like to go back, and thank you for that explication of your article. I'd like to go back to Fukushima for a moment. And, you know, I read every day, or almost every day, about the it's like an outbreak or an epidemic of dead animals on the Pacific coast of the United States and Canada. You know, I have friends who live in California who say they can't walk on the beach anymore without finding a dead seal pup or, you know, a dead fish of some sort, large fish. So what do you think's going on? I mean, you know, we're just not getting told. And, you know, scientists even on the West Coast are saying, well, we don't know, we don't know, we don't know. I mean, why is it so hard to figure out?
I think the we don't know response is really what they're saying is we are paid by some grant that is not allowing us to say what we actually believe and or what we know. And what I think it is, and I don't have these samples from these, you know, seal pups or the dolphins or, you know, any of this. What I think it's a coming together of the worst of our time. And it's hotter oceans, it's radiated oceans, it's dying plant life, it's migrating food, and all of these things coming together to create uninhabitable waters for these animals. On a spiritual level, I also think with the dolphins and the whales, on a spiritual level, oh, and I forgot plastics as well, and oil.
Right.
And the contaminants that the oil companies put into the ocean for disbursement of that oil as well. You know, all of these things are all part of the death machine. And that's what we're seeing. But I was going to say that I have thought about the messages from the whales and the dolphins in the past and thinking about their level of intelligence and how they communicate to us. And I do believe that in knowing their home is are the waters, right? If your home had something in it and you could feel that things weren't right in your home, you would call somebody and say, you know what, something isn't right here, whether it's this isn't working or that isn't working or I'm smelling this, or you call somebody to come help you fix it. They don't have that, you know. So on one level, there are parts of me that feel that there are messages that are coming in as the messengers, our messengers, our animal messengers, our spirit messengers coming to us to say things are so wrong and we are going to beach ourselves to let you know that. But a larger picture of that is we have also ingested plastic. We have ingested chemicals. We have ingested toxins. Our plants are killing us. Our plants have no vitamin form, you know, in them anymore. There's nothing in the nutrition world that we can eat that will sustain us. And then, you know, the rest of everything that we need for, you know, sustenance is no longer here where we live. So I think that's how I view the whole picture. And one of the things that needs to happen, and it must happen, is that people have to demand from places like NOAA, which is hardly for the people, by the way.
Right.
But we need to keep the pressure on organizations like NOAA and on labs that can do this to get samples from our beached animals, from tissue samples and bone samples, and do tests for strontium. Strontium 90, which might be in their bones, that would tell us if they're dying from radiation. Test samples of their tissue for cesium, for anything like this, or do autopsies on them and let the public know what they're finding. Are they finding tracks of plastic? Are they finding in their blood, you know, these oil contaminants? Let us know what we have done so that we can all feel that sense of responsibility and recognize the damage that we all have caused. You know, every time we go to the store and we buy plastic containers, we're supporting petroleum. You know, every time we go to the store and we buy containers that have those plastic, you know, those, they hold all the bottles together, you
right.
know, and
right.
those go into a landfill and then the birds get them and then they choke on them. All of these are our responsibility. And collectively, we are responsible for those animals dying. We are responsible for consuming so much energy that nuclear power feels that they have the right to exist, while we know now that it's killing us and we do nothing about it. So we need to rearrange our thought process here and stop thinking that the answer is going to come from a corporation stopping what it's doing, which of course is necessary, but look at ourselves and say, we have to learn how to unplug our lives to create at least some semblance of betterment to the earth, since we have created such wreckage.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more on that. You know, it's about really looking deeply at what we have done and being willing to take responsibility for that, and a transformation of consciousness. And I keep going back to a love relationship with the earth, that when we can deepen that relationship with the earth, we deepen our own humanity, which for me is what it's really all about at this point, is deepening our humanity. Because I believe we are in a state of planetary hospice. And what do you do in hospice? Well, you know, if like you're a conscious, awake person, you go in there knowing that this is the end. But how am I going to spend the rest of these days? You know, I can spend it in some sort of service. I can spend it by expressing compassion. I can spend it by cleaning up stuff I need to clean up with other people, you know. And I can take a look at my life and really reflect about its meaning and purpose and what I've been doing here all this time. So, yeah, and of course, scientists, you know, the scientific community, by and large, is not going to give us the whole truth so that we can take responsibility because, you know, in this culture, it's not about taking responsibility. It's about being happy. It's a culture of pleasure. You know, it's about acquisition, and it's about huge, huge denial. So I love to listen to you, Mimi, because you speak the truth, and it's also truth that's hard to hear, as much truth is. So, folks that are listening, you know, if you want to share this show, this episode with your friends, just simply go to prn.fm, click on the Lifeboat Hour, click on Shows, and then the Lifeboat Hour, and you will get the podcast of our conversation today. So I want to thank Mimi for being with us today and for the incredible work that you're doing in the world. Mimi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you for having me on your birthday edition. And I know that you are helping so much to make the world a better place, and I appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, thank you as well. And everyone listening, please join us again next week, same time, same place. We're going to have Kevin Hester with us. He's a Kiwi climate tracker from down under in New Zealand. So we're looking forward to a conversation with Kevin next week. Thank you all for listening. Have a good week.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lies.